Welcome to a special presentation of the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Award Ceremony. From 91.3 WYSO, I'm Juliette Frumholt. For the next hour, we'll hear from authors who have been honored for advancing peace through literature. The Dayton Peace Accords ended the war in Bosnia in 1995, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize was created as a response 11 years later. It's the only international literary peace prize in the United States. It honors authors from around the world for fiction, nonfiction, and lifetime achievement. The 2013 nonfiction winner is Andrew Solomon's Far From the Tree. It's a compassionate look at children born with autism, deafness, Down syndrome, and other conditions which Solomon calls horizontal identities. Solomon was introduced by Dayton Literary Peace Prize judge and journalist Ken Bodie.
What happens when you look down at your baby and realize that life has become suddenly unknowable, that parenting for you is now going to be a long, long walk in the dark? Solomon accumulated case studies with 300 families over a period of many years. It's a massive accumulation of evidence and a breathtakingly humane examination of families who know that their children must pursue life on an entirely different playing field from other children. It's a book how parents meet these challenges and how sometimes they don't or can't. Sometimes they have to say, if I'd known it was going to be this deal, I would not have done it. Andrew is a master storyteller. In the chapter on dwarfs, he takes the reader to the Little People of America Conference, an annual place where they go, where everything from dancing to talent shows is designed for little bodies. It's also a once-in-a-year opportunity for dating. And I don't want you to think that this is a heavy book to read. It is not. It's a very inspirational book and a very, sometimes very funny book. As with the dwarfs who say, you know, one thing we all have in common is that when we go to the movie theater, we can't just slip our arms up around our date and let them slide down and touch her breast. Our arms are just too short. Solomon writes about his and his own family's challenges as well. He writes about his dyslexia and the realization that he is gay, his marriage and how he and his partner created their own family. And these things, knowing these things about the author, give the reader a real insight for understanding about how he engaged so meaningfully with the people he interviewed, how intimately he engaged with the families that he interviewed. For me, reading this book was a steep learning curve. In virtually every one of these abnormalities, I learned tons about what I ever knew or even imagined, including the revelation of what happened when a horizontal identity appeared in my own extended family and gave me a better understanding of it and a better capacity for appreciating it. And I'm pleased to welcome Andrew Solomon to come and claim the award he so definitely deserves.
Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no glamorization, no rationalization, and above all, no pretense that it is anything but a pernicious sickness. That was Time magazine in 1966, when I was 3 years old. And in the last year, both the President of the United States and the Supreme Court have expressed support for gay marriage. And I set out to write this book, determined to understand how that had happened, how something that had been universally assumed to be an illness had turned into, instead, an identity. And I wanted to look at what other things that we think of as illnesses could become identities. And in the course of doing that, I wanted to look at how the liberation movements have gone in single file. There was the women's suffrage movement. There was the civil rights movement, of which Thurgood Marshall was an important part. There was the gay rights movement. there now begin to be movements for disability rights and for rights for people with other forms of difference. I was engaged by the idea that each movement relies on the one that came before, but struck by the fact that sometimes the people who have managed to make a transition can be a little bit ungenerous with the people who are behind them. So all of the gay people wanted to say we're just like all of those black people you gave rights to a few years ago. But there was some resistance initially from some members, certainly not from all, but from some members of the civil rights movement to that appropriation of their history. And I decided that instead of merely huddling on the sort of safe far side of the ravine with the others who had been accepted, that I would look and see who was in line next and who was coming along behind us. And that became the guiding principle of my book. When I was perhaps 6 years old, I went with my mother and my brother to a shoe store. And at the end of getting our shoes fitted, we were told that each of us could have a balloon, and we could choose the color of balloon we wanted. And my brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said that she thought I would really rather have a blue balloon. And I said, no, I really wanted the pink balloon. And she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, gives you some evidence of my mother's influence and its limits. It was a very different world then, and she wanted to protect me from prejudice and to protect me from the possibility of never having a family of my own, because she thought that having a family was one of life's greatest joys. And what has happened since then is that the world has shifted and changed. But we can never be complacent about that shifting and changing, and we can never assume that because there's been progress, onward progress is inevitable. This morning, I was with the other award recipients at an event at which we all spoke, and at the end of it, I was walking out of the theater and up the aisle, through an audience of people who had chosen to come to an event for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And one man pulled me aside and said, "But you've got to admit that this gay rights thing has gone too far." And I said, "No, I don't see that I have to admit that." He said, "It's influencing children. It's a terrible thing. It has to be brought under control." One runs up against these things more often than one would think. One is running up against them now in looking at the attitudes of the corporations who are sponsoring the Olympics in Sochi, most of whom have refused to take any stance whatsoever about the current laws against homosexual propaganda that are flying in in Russia. It's devastating to see that lack of support. In the introduction, you heard a bit about my idea of vertical versus horizontal identity. I would add to that the idea that all parents have effectively two obligations. One is to change our children. We want to educate them. We want to teach them hygiene. We want to teach them manners. Not to change your children is to neglect them and is a terrible crime. But we also need to accept our children for who they are. And there are some things that are clearly unchangeable and that we clearly need only to accept. And there are some things that clearly need to be altered and changed. And then there's a lot that's in the middle. And we don't know what the boundary should be between the changing and the accepting. And we don't know what the boundary should be between the love that has presumably been there from the very beginning and the attempt to wrap our minds around children who are essentially very different than we are. There have been generations of activists who have worked toward bringing about these changes. Everyone is aware that there's been a shift in the way that we think about gay people. But let me give you another quote from the Atlantic Monthly in 1968. That was then, of course, considered a bastion of liberal opinion. An ethicist wrote, "There is no reason to feel guilty about putting a Down syndrome child away. Whether it is put away in the sense of hidden in a sanitarium or in a more responsible, lethal sense. It is sad, yes, dreadful, but it carries no guilt. True guilt arises only from an offense against a person, and a Downs is not a person." We've developed these various exceptions notwithstanding, a more tolerant society, a society which embraces difference of every kind more readily, a society that's more open to the idea that human diversity matters just as much as species diversity does, a society which looks to the idea that we can all learn to love the children we have, that we can all learn to love and respect the citizenry that we have. Since the time when that was published, the outcome for people with Down syndrome has been changed beyond recognition. People with Down syndrome now live more than twice as long as they did when that was published. Their educational attainments because of innovations in modes of education for people with DS have been extraordinary. One woman I know who worked for many years with people who had intellectual disabilities described going out to lunch with the person who plays the Down syndrome role and who himself has Down syndrome on Glee. And she said people came over to the table and asked for his autograph. And she said he was a celebrity first and a person with a disability second. And I never imagined I would live to see a day when that was possible. It's an extraordinary kind of progress. And I found as I talked to parents over and over again about what it was like to have children who had these various kinds of difference. They were cataloged in the introduction, so I won't go through them all again, but many of them things that seem undesirable. Some of them, like being a prodigy, things that actually seem desirable but represent enormous challenges and differences of their own. What I found over and over again was that people had ended up achieving this remarkable thing, not only of loving, but also of accepting their children. I think over and over again of what one woman said after her very, very, very severely disabled son, who had neither speech nor the ability to walk, and who might to a casual observer have seemed fairly inert, but who was richly human to her, after he died tragically through caregiver neglect. She said at the interment of his ashes, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted, and once of the son I loved." Now, I don't mean to say that having a disability in the family is an automatically joyful experience or that it doesn't come with enormous anguish and enormous difficulty of various kinds. And I was interested in where this resilience came from that allowed families to do so well, some of the families I was writing about, and how they could do so well even as they described such agonizing experiences and such personal agony. And one of the people I interviewed said to me, quite wonderfully, I think, also the mother of two children with very severe disabilities, she said, "People always regale us with these little sayings like, 'God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.' But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen." I ended up finding that many of the people I interviewed were grateful for lives that they would have done anything to avoid. And I ended up thinking that the negotiation of difference within a family is actually something that everyone deals with. I've yet to meet anyone who hasn't occasionally looked at his or her son or daughter and said, "What planet did you come from?" And I think that by looking at these more extreme forms of difference, we gain some insight into the general practice that parents have of reconciling with the ways that their children are alien or foreign to them. And so I think, ironically, that difference is what unites us, that the negotiation of these differences is actually a thing that almost all of humanity has in common. And that while each of the individual differences can be very isolating, only so many families dealing with schizophrenia, only so many families of people who are transgender, only so many families of dwarfs, that actually if you look at the commonalities in those experiences, you discover an enormous and very powerful community whose time has come. We think of peace much of the time as something we bring to or seek for in war and peace situations, many of them in faraway places involving organized armies embarked on terrible missions. But I think that my receiving this prize today is to me a message that there is some recognition that peace, like charity, begins at home. There has to be peace within the individual. There has to be peace in the encounter between that individual and the family. There has to be peace in the way that family is integrated into a larger society. And when that happens, there can be a negotiation of peace beyond the confines of that society and in the larger world. I think that idea of an embracing peace that begins in the individual and extends outward is a very beautiful idea, and I'm deeply, deeply honored to accept this award with that view in mind. Thank you.
That was Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, which won the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. You're listening to a special presentation of speeches from the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Award Ceremony held on November 3, 2013 at the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio. This year's winning fiction book, Adam Johnson's The Orphan Master's Son, takes us inside North Korea under the Kim regime. Johnson was introduced by 2012 Fiction Award winner Andrew Krivak.
The imaginative reach of literary fiction is a hand, not of fact ultimately, but of possibility. The possibility of telling a story that floods light into unlit corners of imaginations and tells truths beyond the either-or of truth or lie, coming to life as much in how a story is told as in what it contains. The Orphan Master's Son is a novel wherein possibility emerges continually in the face of impossible truths. Is this true? The fictional dear leader of a real North Korea asks the character who is the face and voice and name of what is possible in the novel, and then demands, out with the truth. To which this character, whom we dare not even call the main character, for he is all things and no one in name, replies, I have given you a piece of me, and now you know who I really am. Operatic in the layers of voices that we hear and unfolding like an intricately woven tapestry of faces, visions, brief glimpses of a world wherein the simple beauty of the sun in the morning and nightmares of a darkness, yet too horrible to imagine, exist next to each other like lovers walking side by side, too afraid to hold hands. The Orphan Master's Son culminates on the truth of self-emptying sacrifice, powerful in that it remains only a piece of what is given. But it is this piece, and yes, I want you to hear both meanings in that word, the piece of what is broken off and the piece that comes at the end of a struggle. That the orphan has found his story, that the totalitarian state for the moment is overcome, and we the readers know that we have glimpsed the truth of what is possible in an impossible world. A world in which we cannot forget, no matter how hard it is to imagine, that except for starvation, they didn't have a care in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you this year's winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction, author of The Orphan Master's Son, Adam Johnson.
It was almost 10 years ago that I read the story of Kang Chol-hwan, a man who was interned for 9 years in Camp 15, which is a labor gulag in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The way that North Korea transfers terror from the regime to the individual is through the family. When one person commits or is perceived to commit a crime against the state, the whole family goes to one of these camps, places for which there are no trials or sentences because that's it. 50,000 people toil in Yodok, which is Camp 15, and there's another 50,000 or so in Camp 1418, a sister gulag. And these places are real. It's morning right now on the other side of the world, and all of these people are waking to go into the timber fields and down into the mines. Reading Kang's life was disorienting and very defamiliarizing for me, an average person living my average life in America. What was this strange place, North Korea, I wondered, and what did I know of it? I had heard that the famine struck in the 90s. I'd heard of that. I knew there were some big bombs in North Korea. I'd seen the marionette of Kim Jong-il sing I'm So Ronery on Team America World Police. Which is a portrait not too far from the one I had in my mind of Kim Jong-il, a man with bouffant hair and elevator shoes and jumpsuits, and who was famous for shooting holes in one, right, at North Korea's lone golf course on Yanggak Island. I had seen videos of North Korean children trained to robotically sing and dance while proclaiming that they lived in the greatest nation on earth, a worker's paradise with universal health care and total happiness. Portraits of evil, absurdity, buffoonery, insanity, that was all I had received of the American media with regard to an entire country and its people. But then I read Kang's memoir. Kang never did learn who in his family had fallen afoul of the state. It was perhaps an uncle, but his entire family was sent away. Kang was only 9 when this happened. He was too young to understand what a labor camp was, which is why he insisted on bringing his beloved fish with him. And this portrait of a boy entering perhaps the worst gulag on earth with his aquarium was really the first human look I'd had at North Korea. And I had a little boy, and I just started to care. And I think it's funny how easy it is to not care about other human beings. We know what's going on in the DR Congo and Sudan and Somalia and many places in the world. We know the hardships that people are facing when we drive past a prison or a hospital or an impoverished neighborhood. Yet, it's not until we actually know the struggles of an individual that we become invested. And the way we do that is through narrative. We can shake our heads at the fate of a nation, but the story of a boy can kind of just change your course a little bit. Kang's story got me reading more, and I quickly devoured a ream of books about North Korea. I realized I didn't know much about Korean history or culture or about the Korean War, a dark chapter in our nation's history that, beyond a television show, we as a people have not really confronted. Most of the books I read about North Korea focused on economics and politics and military issues, and very few were just about people. And then I discovered that the stories of average North Koreans, the ones I was hungering for, weren't in books. They were online. They were being gathered by aid workers and missionaries who were assisting defectors out of the northern border across the Yalu and Tumen rivers. Here were the personal narratives of average North Koreans, stories of long hours at sewing machines and self-criticism sessions and guard duty in the cornfields and rabbit breeding on the roofs, and stories of living in housing blocks. Here were stories of the arduous march, as the famine was known to them. Stories like these way more than you would think. When they're placed in your hands, they're like stones that you have to carry around. And I wonder, where's the point at which, after you've begun to care, that you start to act? I'll never forget the story that did this to me. It was the story of a young woman discovering suddenly that she was starving, which sounds strange to me. It was a very strange story to come across. She lived in North Hamgyong province, and her family was foraging the hills for food, which was a normal daily activity for them. They hunted wild yarrow and ginger. She was with her parents and 2 uncles when the 5 of them found a rotting pear on the ground, and they gathered around as the father cut it into 4 slices. And then he apologized to his daughter that there was not a slice for her. And that's when it struck her that this wasn't hunger, that this was starving. She asked him point blank, "Are we starving?" And he denied it. And she suddenly realized how foolish she'd been, how naive to think that other people were starving, but not her family and not her. And she said she became very angry with him. "Admit it," she said. "Admit that we're starving," she told him. And even though this is an experience as farther than anything I had ever experienced, I felt like I was right there. And this story was like one of those heavy stones that you have to carry around. And as a writer, there's only one way to unburden yourself of stories like this, and that's to try telling them. And I tell my students that the odds are quite low that a person who has an important story to tell will also have the abilities to tell it. That means people who happen to have a gift for storytelling also have a duty to tell the stories of others who, for whatever reason, cannot tell their own. And I wondered then if I couldn't take all the real stories I'd come across and fashion them into that portrait I'd been looking for of a normal person from North Korea, an average citizen from the lowest of stations. And just the notion of this plagued me with doubt. Who was I to write this story? That was a question I asked myself every single day for 6 years. I wasn't Korean. I had never been to Korea. I didn't speak Korean. I'd never known hunger or war or an intense physical pain. And when I tried to starve myself to see what hunger was like and not eat for a couple days, which is a big deal for me, it wasn't real because I knew I could eat whenever I wanted, you know. These doubts never went away. But I knew from my research that North Koreans were not allowed to tell their own stories. In fact, we don't have evidence of a single unauthorized play or poem or book making it out of North Korea in 60 years and 3 generations. Even in the worst days of the Soviet gulags, writers risked their lives to create works that responded to the darkness and absurdity around them. Solzhenitsyn wrote in the gulags and had his book smuggled out. There may be an artistic underground in North Korea, but we have no evidence of it. This means that no North Korean has read a novel as you would think of it, a book that explores the human condition, that speaks back, that holds a mirror to society. In fact, after the Japanese occupied the peninsula in 1910, they made Korean literature and music and art illegal. All the Koreans were taught Japanese and given Japanese names. And then after that 35-year period in which their own culture was stolen from them, then came World War II, partitioned by the superpowers, the Korean War, and in the North, 60 years of a Stalinist dictatorship. So for those people, they've been separated from their own cultural tradition for a century. But what are those who make it out of North Korea? They too face great challenges in telling their stories. These are people who have been taught their entire lives not to express their inner thoughts. They're traumatized by their escapes. And because their freedom comes at the expense of those who are left behind, they suffer survivor's guilt. And it may be another generation before they recover their narratives. If it's true that we find it hard to care about others without the personalizing immediacy of their stories, how do we approach an entire people who've been silenced? I do believe that writing outside one's own experience is to trespass in the lives of others. So writing across racial, cultural lines, things like that, come with great risk. But I still ask myself, who am I to write about the lives of people so far away from me? I started asking this other question, though, that stands beside it, which is, why aren't more writers trying to lend their voices to such a people who have been so silenced? Right now, it seems to me it's only through the imaginative reach of narrative that one can vault these borders of the Kim dynasty. And it's only through narrative that we can restore the humanity of a people who are all too often reduced to abstractions and caricatures in our popular culture. I think my book was maybe one of the first books in our society to attempt to do this. And perhaps one day we'll look back and say, oh, what was Johnson thinking? Or Johnson got it all wrong. And I hope if that happens, it comes from a place in which many people have attempted to give voice to those who have lost it, and that hopefully, most importantly, North Koreans are free enough to tell their own stories. And that's the story I'm looking for anyway. And I hope that day comes soon. Thank you.
Adam Johnson, winner of the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction for his book, The Orphan Master's Son. The Richard C. Holbrooke Distinguished Achievement Award honors writers whose body of work is about or connected to the idea of peace. The 2013 recipient was Wendell Berry. He's a Kentucky native who's published more than 50 works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. A farmer and a teacher, Barry's work deals with our essential relationship with the earth. Tim O'Brien, last year's Distinguished Achievement Award winner, introduces Wendell Berry.
If the word distinguished is fitting to anyone in American letters, the word is appropriate when joined to the name Wendell Berry. Heir to Ben Franklin and Henry David Thoreau, literary descendant of Thomas Jefferson and Walt Whitman, spiritual neighbor of Sinclair Lewis and Sherwood Anderson, Wendell Berry is both a writer's writer and a people's writer, at once intensely personal and intensely public, attaching fresh and lucid language to his own and to our own cravings for harmony, justice, civility, and peace. To describe Wendell Berry's body of work would be to reduce it, and thereby to demean it. And yet, if I were pressed by the devil to supply a list of adjectives, and if the brimstone were hot enough, the pitchfork sharp enough, I would no doubt cough up such words as intimate, precise, outraged, gentle, hopeful, graceful, impassioned, rigorous, and original. As with any great writer, Wendell Berry combines language and memory and imagination to create spirits that inhabit the heads and the hearts of his readers. On this occasion tonight, I think it's most appropriate to end this introduction by allowing Wendell Berry to introduce himself. Let's listen for a second to Wendell Berry. Rats and roaches live by competition under the laws of supply and demand. It is the privilege of human beings to live under the laws of justice and mercy. Let's listen to Wendell Berry. How many deaths of other people's children by bombing or starvation are we willing to accept in order that we may be free, affluent, and supposedly at peace? To that question, I, Wendell Berry, answer none. None. Please. No children. Don't kill any children for my benefit. Listen to Wendell Berry. Though our leaders in war always assume that there is an acceptable price, there is never a previously stated level of acceptability. The acceptable price, finally, is whatever is paid. Listen. How can a society that justifies capital punishment and warfare prevent its justifications from being extended to assassination and terrorism? If a government perceives that some causes are so important as to justify the killing of children, how can it hope to prevent the contagion of its logic spreading to its own citizens or to its citizens' children? Ladies and gentlemen, let us now welcome and then carefully listen to the recipient of the 2013 Richard C. Holbrooke Distinguished Achievement Award, Mr. Wendell Berry.
I am, of course, grateful for this award and all that it means. And I am, of course, necessarily humbled and somewhat troubled by it. There's something a little odd, after all, in giving an award associated with peace to any member of an industrial society. For the industrial economy, from agriculture to war, is by far the most violent the world has ever known, and we are all complicit in its violence. The history of industrialization has been violent from the start, as the Luddites quickly learned. The purpose of labor-saving technology has always been to cheapen work by displacing workers, thus increasing the flow of wealth from the less wealthy to the more wealthy. It is a fact, one we have never adequately acknowledged or understood, that at the end of World War II, industry geared up to adapt the mechanical and chemical technologies of war to agriculture and other ways of using land. At the same time, certain corporate and academic leaders, known collectively as the Committee for Economic Development, decided that there were too many farmers. The relatively self-sufficient producers on small farms needed to become members of the industrial labor force and consumers of industrial commodities. Reducing the number of farmers and farms became a devastatingly effective national policy. The first problem of a drastic reduction of the land-using population is to keep the land producing in the absence of the people. The Committee for Economic Development and their allies were fully aware of this problem, and they had a ready solution. The absent people would be replaced by the mechanical and chemical technologies developed for military use and subsisting upon a seemingly limitless bounty of natural resources, mainly ores and fuels. Agriculture would become an industry. Farms would become factories like other factories, ever more automated and remotely controlled. Industrial land use became a front in a war against the living world. And so, with a few exceptions, the free market was allowed to have its way. Finally, nearly all of the land-using population have left their family farms and their home places and moved or commuted into the cities to be industrially or professionally employed or unemployed, and to be entirely dependent upon the ways and the products of industrialism. This process of eliminating the too many farmers still continues. Nobody ever said how many were too many. Nobody ever said how many might actually be necessary. Even so, to remove the farmers from farming required a shift of interest from husbanding the fertility of the land to burning the fossil fuels, with consequences so far less famous than terrifying. But there was another problem that the population engineers did not recognize then and have not recognized yet. Agricultural production without land maintenance leads to exhaustion. Land that is in use, if the use is to continue, must be used with care. And care is not and can never be an industrial product or an industrial result. Care can come only from what we used to understand as the human heart, so called because it is central to human being. The human heart is informed by the history of care and the need for care, also by the heritage of the skills of caring and of caretaking. The replacement of our displaced rural families by technologies derived from warfare has involved inevitably a supposedly acceptable and generally accepted violence against land and people. By it, we established an analogy between land use and war that has remained remarkably consistent ever since. The common theme is a terrible pragmatism that grants an automatic predominance of the end over the means. The sacrifice of land and people to the objective of victory, domination, security, or profit, in oblivion or defiance of any moral or natural law that may stand in the way. All of our prevalent forms of land use, which is to say land use minus care, produces, in addition to commercial products, massive waste and destruction. War is politics minus neighborly love plus technological progress, which makes it ever more massively wasteful and destructive. There is, in fact, no significant difference of means between mass destruction and massive destruction. In order to mine a seam of coal in eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, we destroy a mountain, its topsoil, and its forest, with no regard for the ecosystem or for the people downhill, downstream, and later in time. The difference between explosion in the coal fields and erosion in the corn and soybean fields is only that erosion is slower. The end, the exhaustion of nature's life-supporting systems, is the same. But this should not surprise us if we have understood at all the history of industrial war. In his ironically titled book, Freedom from Fear, David M. Kennedy wrote that by August 1945, the atomic bombs hardly represented a moral novelty. The moral rules that had once stayed men's hands from taking up weapons of mass destruction against non-combatants had long since been violently breached in World War II, first in the aerial attacks on European cities, then even more wantonly in the systematic firebombing of Japan. He might have added other instances of such destruction in that war by our enemies, our allies, and ourselves. Beyond the scope of Professor Kennedy's book, the instances of this disregard go on and on, always elaborately justified as national righteousness and the defense of freedom. In the accounting of our wars, we speak often of the human cost to our side, the lives of young people spent, as we say, in defense of our way of life. We speak little of the human costs and collateral damages paid by our enemies. We speak almost never of the ecological costs of industrial war, which we must assume to be as great, as unsustainable, as the ecological costs of industrial land use. But surely, by now, the official rationalizations of our violence have become too obviously hypocritical to be ignored. Violence against our world and our fellow beings finally cannot be dissociated from the violence of untruth. How can we continue to insist that our land-destroying, water- and air-polluting agriculture is the only way to feed the world, especially now since we have devoted so much of it to biofuels to feed our automobiles? How can we assume that the world can be fed by an agriculture that continues to assign the greatest risks, the lowest income, and no regard at all to the producers? Why should we think that high rates of production can be maintained when the land is increasingly degraded and ever fewer farmers' children want to farm? Moreover, why should we continue to believe that our government is uniquely to be trusted with our weapons of mass destruction, whereas other nations are not to be trusted with them? What does trustworthiness mean in relation to the possession of weapons of mass destruction? Why is the cost of our wars now paid almost exclusively by the young people in the armed services who must pay with their bodies and their lives? Why do our patriotic citizens and their representatives not insist upon the tax increases necessary to support our wars? Why do they not ration or otherwise curtail our overuse of fuels and materials necessary to our wars? Such questions, no doubt, are merely naive. Surely prevarication, bad faith, self-serving, and nonsense must be normally and expectably among the costs of representative government. Surely, despite such frailties, but assisted by the will of God and his prejudice in our favor, our rights will be preserved and our freedoms will endure. We speak of freedom, of our God-given freedom, of defending, using, and destroying freedom, as of something memorized in grade school and never thought of again. We might as well be talking in our sleep. We have been so thoughtless and careless of our freedom for so long that by now we cannot see that our assumed right to be limitlessly violent would finally bring us to violence against freedom that may destroy it and that will be extremely difficult to oppose. I am speaking of our present massive effort of so-called national security, comprised of an immense force of secret police, regulated by processes and persons equally secret, and possessing a gigantic technology of surveillance, also secret, which it has used to intrude into the private communications of every citizen of our own country and evidently every citizen in the world who has the misfortune of a computer or a telephone. And all of this with no hint of probable cause and without a sham or shadow of due process. A people inured to violence, even as entertainment, may have difficulty in seeing such an unassertive, so far, enterprise of security as violent. After all, we would not yet even have heard of it had not an alleged criminal, by an exemplary act of citizenship, apprised us of its existence. But of course it is violent. Under our system of government, it is violent in its conception and purpose. It violates the Fourth Amendment's guarantee of the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. It violates our most intimate and natural sense of personal privacy that is the source and justification of the Fourth Amendment. It is a flagrant insult legally to our Constitution and personally to ourselves. It is a blatant assertion of absolute and unquestionable power, exactly the totality of government that we have claimed to be opposing in all the wars of my lifetime, and of course every imaginable violence is potential in it. Almost as dismaying as this secretive and tyrannous security is the talk among people reputedly intelligent of the need to balance freedom and security. Balance is an unfortunate word here, for it raises two extremely perilous questions. Who is to load the scales? And who is to position the fulcrum? In our customary glibness about freedom, are we now supposing that it is a substantial commodity, some of which can be portioned off and exchanged for another commodity called security. But there can be no balance between freedom and secret police, freedom and universal suspicion, freedom and tyranny. There is only choice. If we have the courage, we will choose freedom. And we will use it to oppose our government's frivolous and dangerous secrecy, which it imposes upon us under the claim of security, but really to hide its abuse of power and its shame. Peace comes from freedom, real freedom. It comes from responsibility, real acceptance of responsibility. Freedom is not simple, for it always is involved with responsibility. The relation between freedom and responsibility is not a balance to be expediently adjusted by governments or citizens who, without both, can have neither. I have quoted John Milton's definition of freedom before, and I'm going to quote it again, for it is complex and precise enough to have the force of an essential justice. To be free, Milton wrote, is precisely the same thing as to be pious, wise, just, and temperate. Careful of one's own, abstinent from what is another's, and thence, in fine, magnanimous and brave.
Wendell Berry, recipient of the 2013 Richard C. Holbrooke Distinguished Achievement Award. You've been listening to a special presentation of the 2013 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Award Ceremony. To learn more about the award, visit daytonliterarypeaceprize.org. Special thanks to Sharon Rabb and Jenny Chang for 91.3 WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. I'm Juliette Frumholdt.